ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for tuning in. This is Red Ice TV. Henrik here. Always a pleasure having you with us. Today we have an exciting show for you. We're going to go back to a topic that we discussed a couple of years ago with our friend Jan Ott, who's talking about the Uera Linda book. Really fascinating material. I let him explain it because it's an in-depth story. I see it as a mythological record, really. It's an ancient scripture that's been copied, which seems to suggest an ancient pre-European or like a prehistoric European civilization, the Frisians. We'll get into more of this later, but Jan wanted to bring on another guest, one that actually Jan got in touch with after we did the first show together. Sivan is with us, and we have been talking a little bit here about her work. She's an academic. So first of all, obviously, welcome Jan, but also welcome Sivan. Thank you to both of you for coming on.
Thank you, Henrik. It's a great honor.
Yeah, and it's great to be here, too. Thank you very much for having me.
You bet. So we're going to talk a little bit with you, Sivan, about your interest in both the academic field, but in history and stuff like that, too. So, Jan, why don't you just kind of introduce Sivan a little bit? Tell us how you guys got in touch first.
Well, after we had done the interview with you, sometime later, Sivan wrote me and explained that she had become interested and that she wanted to help out. So she joined the hidden forum that we had, and she started helping proofreading. And recently we've also agreed that she will write an introduction to the new translation that we are making. And I found it particularly interesting what she told me about Irish history, so I hope she can tell us about that, regarding the relevance of the Uera Linda book, perhaps, for our culture.
Yeah, exactly. Tell us about that, Sivan, a little bit. You tell us how your interest got started in the book after hearing that show.
So I came across it quite accidentally, and I started to read the older translation, and a lot of the material really resonated with me because I'd seen this type of material before in my academic research and my time as a student. I studied Celtic civilization, and then afterwards I worked a lot on Old English texts, and then I moved into early modern texts, actually, which is what I did my PhD in. But a lot of the material that I read in it, I'd come across before in many different sources, in Irish sources, Anglo-Saxon sources, ancient German sources, in Roman sources. And I felt that if this was a fake or a forgery, which was what I'd read about it, I felt that this would be very difficult to achieve. You'd have to do a huge amount of research and reading and archaeological research even to come up with all of these details. So I quickly got it out of my mind that this was a forgery. I don't believe it's a forgery. And if it is, it would have to be a team of academics working on it to create it. So that was how it grasped my interest. And so I guess the big text that I would see it has a huge similarity with is an Irish text called the Leabhar Gualla Éire, which is very, very similar. And it's a mythic history of the Irish people. Again, it's very, very mythical. It's dated to the 11th century, the Leabhar Gualla Éire, and it's written down by Christian monks. So they weave in a lot of Christianity into it as well, but it preserves a lot of the ancient myths about Ireland and begins 3,000 years before Christ, and there's a flood and all of these different invasions and things like that as well. And so that's that was that that that, that, that that was how that was the main thing that piqued my interest. Yeah. I mean, there's other parts of the Oeira Linda, which are echoed throughout many, many different texts and artifacts in Europe. This the cult of the mothers and things like that. That's very, very old. That is accepted among historians and archaeologists that before the warrior society in Europe, there was a cult of the mothers before that, and you find artifacts about that all over Europe. There's very little written documentation about that because it's before the Romans and the Greeks, and the Romans and the Greeks are the first to actually start to write history down. But even in the Roman and Greek sources, you find a lot of information about the veneration of these. There was like female priestesses, cults of female priestesses. The most famous one is Vileda, who Tacitus writes about, and it's very, very similar to what you find written in the Oeira Linda. As well.
Yeah. So that's interesting, though, that there's cross-correlation, because I think, you know, we talked about that last time. Like, shouldn't there be other, you know, texts and stuff? Maybe not texts, but at least mythological stories artifacts too, exactly, that cross-correlate the story.
And there is. I think there's, I live in southwest Germany. I think there's something like 80 artifacts about the mothers. The cult of the mothers in this part of Germany, where there was like altars created by ancient Germanic tribes honoring these mothers, all different types, all different names.
Interesting. So there's some context, of course, to other civilizations, or whether it was just one big kind of a common shared culture. We don't know. It's probably through geographical separation at some point that you had small differences, but it's about the big picture kind of thing.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, there's no black and white. You know, it's all different shades of gray.
Right. Exactly.
Very complex. Yeah.
So that kind of explains up as your interests and how it's personally tied to you know your own people, your own group, if you will, their mythology and how it correlates with the others. Mm-hmm. What about the aspect that, you know, you as an academic, and feel free to share with us what you've studied and stuff like that too, if you want to. But tell us about the bearing of some of this kind of material. Most of it is kind of, I guess, I would say that there is an intentional bearing, but much of it is basically like due to the fact that there's so few written sources, right? That they say, well, we don't know. It's kind of mythological, therefore, and they tend to kind of dismiss it. Although that we have, you know, the verbal account, we can piece things together, maybe from the archaeological record. And then we have some of these rare texts. But has there been an active burying of this material, would you say?
Well, I just don't understand what's happening in this situation, because I come from Ireland, and I know that in Ireland and Britain, these types of texts, a huge amount of research is done on them. There's scholarly grants available to work on them. The governments are very interested in them and devote an awful lot of money into conducting research on them. So there's a lot known about the Lower Gowalla era, or old manuscripts in Britain, such as the Beowulf manuscript. These are really, really treasured items and continuously worked on and researched on. So I find it just really bizarre about this manuscript, because it's not getting as much scholarly attention that I think it deserves. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's true. I mean, I've personally always been interested in the Beowulf story, the saga. It talks about the Goths, which is, of course, where I was born and stuff like that. It's very interesting.
Yeah. And the Goths were really famous for their cult of the... Well, they had a cult of the female priestess cult that they sent away. But I saw that in the Oeira Linda, that the Geats are mentioned. So in Beowulf, they call themselves the Geats. And again, you know, picking up on little nuances like that, that requires, if somebody was to forge that, we'll say, you'd have to do some research in that. You could, I mean, if they wrote down Goths, and the Beowulf if they wrote down Goths and the Oer Elinja manuscript, it would show like a lack of understanding of the terminology and the lexicon of that period. But they get it right. They have the right terms. They refer to many different groups using the right names.
Yeah. What else? Is there something specifically that stands out to you in the book that you find, I don't know, particularly fascinating, or an area where you'd love to know more, or maybe there is somehow more information that could be obtained about certain aspects of it? What would that be, if so?
I mean, I find the veneration of the kind of priest, the Freya priestesses, and the mothers, the Borg mothers, I think that they're called, very, very interesting. I find that, and that's really bared out in artifacts. And I think that a lot of it could be bared out looking at more archaeological evidence, because there's very little textual evidence, but there is a lot of archaeology.
Jan, what do you think is important as well to ask Sivan about in terms of her work, her academic research, in relation to what you know about the book?
Well, Sivan knows so much more than I do about the various other sources and the archaeology.
Is there something in particular you would like to kind of, ask her about, I guess?
Yeah, what would be good to point out, perhaps, because many people who have not studied or who don't know the academic culture, maybe they don't realize that there's also a lot of political correctness, and that it's not always, that historians are not always free to research anything they want. There are taboos in academia. And that it's possible that certain texts are ignored, or for that reason do not get the attention that they deserve.
But isn't it the Oer Elinja book has plenty of controversy around it because of the wrong people got interested in the book? Isn't that so?
Yes. Well, Heinrich Himmler was very interested in this book. It's a long, complicated story, but there are a few examples of speeches that he gave in which he referred to Uralda, that was the name of the supreme or oldest god that they mentioned in this book. This could only have come from the Oer Elinja book. And he also used the six-spoke wheel in many occasions. And he had the manuscript secretly researched.
Right, so it's like the wrong guy that got interested in that material. That's pretty
interesting. Well, the strange thing is that there are documentaries about the hidden, the occult sides of the SS.
Of course, yeah.
But never have they mentioned this. I've seen nothing mentioning this. Also, I haven't read anything about it, although it's so obvious.
Sivan, tell us a bit about your academic work and how you perceive that to be these days, in context of what Jan just talked about, in the aspect that there's areas that are consciously being excluded. In this case, how it relates to the Oer Elinja book, or even an ancient Indo-European or Indo-Aryan civilization, mm-hmm. is of course that they don't seem particularly too interested in that kind of material. But what would you say about this?
So I'll just give you some background about my academic career first, and then I'll answer your question. So I did a Bachelor of Arts first of all, and that was when I studied I studied literature, primarily English literature, and I studied Celtic civilization as well. Then I did a Master's in medieval and Renaissance English, and then I did my PhD looking at Anglo-Dutch cultural exchange in the Renaissance. So, I worked a lot. I have worked a lot on a variety of different, very old English texts, and because I was teaching Old English while I was doing my PhD, and came across just so much fascinating material. And then when I was working on my PhD, I worked a lot actually on how literature was used to basically persuade people, manipulate people, force people to believe and support and participate in certain political regimes. So I was working on the 80 Years' War in the Netherlands, and it made me see how ideologies can be used to influence people. And while I was doing my PhD, I was very surprised how much material is not supported or suppressed. I would say the vast majority of young researchers are really passionate about their work and love what they're working on. They love the period they're working in. They're highly, highly motivated about it. But first of all, to do a PhD, you need to get approval to do it. So you have to submit a proposal, and you have to find a supervisor who will work with you on it. And if you have any challenging ideas at that stage, you're obviously not going to even get in the door. Then after that, any material which could be problematic might be taken out of your PhD thesis, because that could make issues for you in the VIVA, which is this oral exam that you have at the end. Or if it's left in, it won't be published if your PhD is published at the end. So what I saw, I saw something that really alarmed me when I was going through the PhD process, and I knew somebody who was working on the use of Flemish and French in Belgium. So it was in the Belgian context, and they had discovered that certain communes in Wallonia, which is a French-speaking part of Belgium, were all formerly Flemish-speaking, and they couldn't write about this or publish this. It had to be all completely suppressed because the university said that this would disrupt the political situation in Belgium because it's so sensitive.
Really?
Yes. They were very, very worried about it. So it was at a conference actually that they spoke about it. So there was only maybe about five or six academics in this room listening to them speak about it, but that's just one example. So
yeah.
I know that the political situation in Belgium is really sensitive, so I'm very compassionate to them about that, but I feel that that's very interesting information and has a direct impact on today's world, so it's not supported.
Yeah, exactly.
I knew a lot of archaeologists who found amazing things in archaeological digs in Ireland, found Viking settlements, solid silver, ceremonial swords, and basically the day after these things would be found, officials would come from Dublin and everything would be taken away and you'd never see it again.
I know I know stories like that myself. I think there was actually even a news piece that focused on it. It's just one example, but it was some specific artifact that had been found in Sweden. I think it was silver as well, and it was actually melted down, I believe. It was destroyed. And I can just imagine how many of these things that they are. For one, I think it's about they have a particular worldview, and if you find something that's kind of out of place, they tend to just, well, you know, this is the history that we have. This is what we know. So the artifacts we find and the studies we do has to fit into that puzzle, and if it doesn't, then they remove it or just put it away until they can either figure it out or just forget about it, right?
Yeah, and it's like the KGB vaults in Russia now. These things will be released in 100 years or 200 years or whatever.
Yeah, if we're lucky, right?
if we're lucky. Yeah. But I guess all of this stuff, for want of a better word, was really shocking for me, as I think it would be for any Irish person, to be honest, because we have a totally different view of ourselves compared to the rest of Northern Europe. And my husband is German, so I became very clear about this after meeting him and marrying him and getting to know his family and everything. Because in Ireland, because our history is a bit different, we're very patriotic. And that's really instilled in us from a young age by the government. It's a positive government decision this time, I guess, depending on who you ask about it. But in Ireland, we were part of England and what you'd now call Britain, which is a very new concept. This is another issue that I get very passionate about sometimes, these new nationalities in Europe that are very, very new. But we were associated, we'll say, with England for 800 years. And look, it's a very complex history. I know a lot about it, so I wouldn't say the Irish were the victims. I don't have any problem with English people about what happened. I know that it was really the Irish. The reason we had 800 years of domination was because Irish people were collaborating with the English for most of that time. But when we finally became independent, our leaders knew the power of ideologies, and they totally recreated Irish historiography and the Irish education system, and they made this patriotism the cornerstone of Irish education. So everybody in Ireland is really proud of being Irish, and they know about their mythology, and they have this, unfortunately, it's kind of a false history as well. We'll say it's not entirely true. But I when I met my husband and met other people here in Germany, I was just so appalled by how, first of all, how ashamed they are of their nationality,
mm-hmm. yeah.
and how they know nothing about this amazing, rich, vibrant history that they have.
Exactly,
and,
yeah.
This is really a tragedy. This is a real tragedy.
I think it's indicative of a bigger picture, and there's many tentacles to this monster, obviously.
Exactly. Yes, because like I mean, as I said to you, the Irish leaders who freed Ireland, took over Ireland, they understood that if you control history, you control somebody's identity. If you control their identity, you control them.
Yeah. So it's what I see in this is that although it can be a patriotic tendency, which I believe is a good thing at the end of it, but if it's based on a simulacrum or something artificial or something constructed, then it's going to be a limited version, and it's not going to be the true thing that actually roots you to that heritage, right?
Exactly. And that's the thing about the Irish context, because most of what we have in terms of our identity in Ireland is actually the real thing, because we've been given our mythology. We have, mythology, you know, it doesn't have to be fact, but it's the record of the soul of that people. That's your ancestors' record that they've given to you, and it's so important. And most of what we have in terms of our identity in Ireland is associated with that, and I think that's really positive. But there's the artificial part to it as well, which is Irish historiography would have you believe that we were constantly invaded, and we were constantly repelling invasions, and we are this homogenous group of Irish people that never mixed with any of these invaders, and we kind of stayed true to our Celtic selves the whole time, which isn't true at all. And it's coming apart recently because there's a new generation of historians after getting into more powerful positions into universities, basically. and they want to work with more, I guess, rebellious approaches towards Irish historiography, and a lot of light is coming. It hasn't reached into the education system, as in the primary and secondary education system yet, but in universities now it's commonly accepted. That
do you think that's a good thing, though? Because I can definitely see how that would be used to break apart kind of the little identity that you guys have left, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, I do. I think it's really positive, because okay. I think the truth will always be a positive move in the right direction. Irish people need to know these things about themselves. There's a lot of shame. I accept that. There's a lot. I mean, most Irish people, the vast majority of Irish people, are part English. I am. Both my parents were, because we had so many wars. The men kept getting killed. Where did we come from? if there was no men around, it was obviously English soldiers would marry the women. And we had a huge amount of English settlers, and it's known as the plantation system and everything. And this is a taboo subject in Ireland. You can't really speak about it.
Yeah, interesting.
But nobody, because our this ideology that's been programmed into us is so strong, but in the younger generations, it's weakening off a bit. And, you know, people are opening up about it and they're admitting it. And it's okay. It's all okay, because that's who we are. And it's okay to tell the truth about things. Just to touch on the big point about what happened in Ireland, as I said, I'll make this really, really quick, but I'll just give you a quick summary. We were part of England for 800 years, and then in the late 19th century we had this huge cultural revolution called the Gaelic Revival, which was where Irish revolutionaries, there was a small group of Irish revolutionaries who wanted a free and independent Ireland, and they actually supported the redevelopment of the Irish language, Irish Gaelic games, rediscovery of our history, and it sparked a huge cultural movement which kind of grew into and then separated and then coalesced with the Irish independence movement. It's much more complicated than that, but I hope that gives you a brief understanding of it, because from the 16th century there would have been a really, really strong program by English and then British governments in Ireland. Mm. First of all, they were ruling in Ireland, then they were ruling from Westminster, to destroy the language, destroy the culture, destroy the Irish history, sense of identity, all of those things. And it was very successfully done for many centuries, which is why we don't speak that much Irish in Ireland anymore. But unfortunately, the power of identity was known even in the 16th century. It's not a new thing.
No, absolutely. Just correlate that story. The same thing would be in Sweden. I personally don't have anything against. Well, I think it's essential, in fact, to have a strong identity, to have a sense of patriotism, if you will. I'm not against that, but I think that what they've given us is kind of a constructed version, basically. We had a true history, and then so much of that has been slowly removed and kind of repositioned and re-put together. I guess where I'm at this point is almost like, I'm with you in terms of, like, yes, it's better with the truth, but sometimes I also know that it can hurt. It's like the little we have left now, I feel, it's like, well, let's not attack that either. Let's at least have some semblance left of it. But I get what you're saying with the truth. I mean, it leads where it leads, right?
Yeah, I mean, I just something really positive has happened in the last couple of months in Ireland, which is why I guess I'm so positive and optimistic about this sort of stuff, because Irish people from the southwest of Ireland have always known that there was a huge Viking influence on our on us as a people, who we were. I mean, Limerick, where I'm from, before the Vikings got there, there was nobody living there because it was disputed for several generations between two Irish tribes. And so when the Vikings arrived, they thought, yippee, hooray, we'll just move into this nice piece of land here. But just recently, another city, which is just about an hour and a half from Limerick, Cork, there was an archaeological survey done there, and they're after finding a huge Viking settlement. And the Norwegian ambassador to Ireland was there when they were uncovering these different things. And people were crying and everything. They were so emotional about it. And it was like in the newspaper saying that, you know, this, the historiography of Cork now has to be completely reconsidered because this was never known about before.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, we know about the lot of excursions that the Vikings did, obviously, and Ireland was one of the areas almost the hardest hit, if you will. So, yeah, that makes sense, you know, yeah.
But it's, again, that is totally, the Viking history of Ireland is totally filled with flaws as well, because what historians prior to this generation of historians would have you think was that it was invasion and death, and that's very, very true, but there's many more mitigating factors, first of all, as to why the Vikings came to Ireland and came to Britain. And a lot of historians are questioning now, did Charlemagne's genocide, basically, against the Saxons and destruction of sacred groves, you know, did this motivate Vikings to start attacking Christian centres in Ireland and Britain.
Exactly. That's one of the theories, I assume, that it was. They were basically a cultural and a genocide going on, if you will, that they eventually decided to fight back against.
It was massive. I mean, I was just reading lately about how after the destruction of the sacred grove in Saxony, there was 4,500 people beheaded in one day because they refused to convert to Christianity. This was during the time of Charlemagne.
Yeah.
This is massive. And this had a ripple effect all through Northern Europe. You know, these sacred groves were visited by Northern European tribes for centuries before that. And sure, there was intertribal conflicts, but the religion was the same. And in the Irish context, it's the Christian centres that are really hit at first. And then there's a period of settlement. And during that time, the Vikings are, when they arrive, they're going immediately to the tribal councils of these tribes in Ireland and making alliances with them and fighting with them against intertribal conflicts that they're having. So there's a really famous battle in Ireland called the Battle of Clontarf, which was always considered to be this big war between the Irish and the Vikings. And now what's really been highlighted by several historians is that there was Irish and Viking together fighting on both sides. So it was actually control. It was actually a battle for the control of Ireland between the Dalcash in the south, and between an alliance between the Danes and Irish tribes in the north.
Interesting. That's very interesting, yeah. I was actually, as you're talking, I was just looking for this one picture, the Echsternstein, right? The interesting rock formation in Germany had this depiction on it where the Irminsul, which is one of the... how would you explain it? I guess a symbol of the natural world, or a symbol of a tree or whatever, bends over to a Christian. Actually, here it is. Let me see if I can just pull that up.
Divine connection between the land and the heavens,
Down in the kind of more towards down the right, you can see that's the Irminsul actually bending, meaning it bends to the will of the cross. You know, I don't know when this rock formation was actually carved. I think it's a bit later, but it's symbolic nonetheless, to kind of tells just a little bit of a part of that story of what happened when it came in. So we know obviously that it was a, you know, very violent period and stuff like that. And I guess just to go back a little bit to the Where Alinda book as well.
Sure. Yeah, I went off on a tangent.
Oh, that's fine. That details, Jan, also this, a longer story of a kind of a conquest, I guess, to a certain extent, right? That these people were slowly pushed out, and we can speculate why that was. Was it simply that these were more, the prior civilization was more, I don't know, maybe it was matriarchal, it was more hunter-gatherer-esque, possibly. The new one that came in was more farming and war-oriented, correct me if I'm wrong, but nonetheless, it was a difference in approach and warfare that led to the demise of the ancient European civilization, which eventually, this is why they were pushed to the brink of Friesland, right? Because it's the very edge of the most western part of the European continent. It seems to have been a war, nonetheless, Jan, that slowly took out these people. Is that right?
I think it happened in various phases. There was, of course, the Roman time, and there's a report from Tacitus, I think, that described how a whole village was destroyed with all the sacred, had the temples and everything that was in it. This has repeated itself many times, even up until the 17th century. There was a war from France against in Holland. But they also burned down complete villages. And from the Franks, I know, I saw in a in a museum in Cologne. There was I will show a picture of that. Even a six-spoke wheel that was, a few parts were found. And it said that the Franks were for several centuries explicitly trying to destroy everything that was, left of the culture.
So in context to the Where Alinda book, which of course we're going to dive into more now with Jan and discuss, we're going to let you go, Sivan, because I know you're busy, but what area would you like to see more research being done on? If is there any specific parts of the book that you find particularly fascinating that you hope maybe there will be more research about in the future? Honest research, I should say.
Yeah, because it's honest, scholarly, objective research is so necessary for this book, because there are just so many minds are needed to piece this together. You know, I mean, look at me. I don't come from the country that book came from, but from the little bit that I know, from the corner of the world that I come from, I'm able to share my knowledge with people who can thereby understand this book better. And I think that people, scholars are needed from Ireland, from Britain, from Germany, from the Netherlands, from Scandinavia, to all work together on this and to share their knowledge concerning the archaeology and classical sources and other mythological sources. I get to try and really give this book the attention it deserves and provide an in-depth understanding for people to read and appreciate, and hopefully to stir something inside them, because I think that in this age of multiculturalism, I think that it's time for people to give the attention they might have been giving elsewhere to their own culture and to their own history and to this big black hole we have in Central Europe, in the Dark Ages, in terms of our own history there, because it's been so destroyed or suppressed by different rulers, Christianity, the current political ideologies, what have you. It's time for all of this stuff to come out and be rediscovered and appreciated by people.
Oh, I agree. Definitely. Well said. Well, thank you for joining us, Sivan. Really appreciate it. We'll have you back in the future. There's more to discuss about your work, of course. But thank you so much. Great to have you here.
Thank you for having me. Have a wonderful evening, and hopefully talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. You're more than welcome.
Okay, folks, so thanks, Yvonne, for joining us here for the first kind of portion of the show. And obviously we spoke a lot about Irish and Gaelic history and, you know, how that kind of fits in. But the main meat of this show is going to be on the Where Alinda book. And whether or not you were part of the, or if you listened to, rather, the first show that we did together, I do want to go over a lot of the material from the top again, from the beginning. We have a lot of new listeners. We have a lot of new viewers that tune in. And so we shouldn't assume that anyone is up to speed. And this is a fairly esoteric work, I guess we could say. It's a very it's a hidden work. You don't hear too much about it. So I would doubt many people are familiar with it, Jan. So let's go over some of this from the beginning, from the top, if you will, and explain to us basically in the shortest way that you can, like summarize, like give us an overview of what the Where Alinda book is for those who don't know.
It is a manuscript that that surfaced in the 1860s, 70s, and it was translated also. It was in the possession of a private person in a, who had had it in his family for many generations. When it became known, when people started writing about it, and when the especially when the translation was published, there was a huge controversy. Some people thought it was a forgery. It was created in the 19th century. Others thought it was an authentic 13th century copy. It is a collection of old laws, histories that were first compiled in the 6th century BC. And then later texts were added to it. And the current version is a copy from the 13th century. There were themes in it that in that time probably were already very explosive, even before it was published. The people involved were ridiculed. They were accused of things. It was a heated discussion. And since then, there has not been an open, honest discussion about it. So even today, there's very little people actually in Holland who even know of its existence. I would guess less than 1%. You would say that even if it was a forgery from the 19th century, 190 pages in a language that would be proto-Old Frisian, you could say. Yeah, there's the Old Frisian of the known sources, but this would even be an older version of that, with traces not only in Dutch and Frisian, but also very much similar to Old German, Old Saxon, Old English, and even also Old Scandinavian, mainly the Northern, Western, Northwestern European languages.
Yeah, I mean, I recognize a lot of the words. I mean, we share, of course, many already in Dutch and Swedish, but I recognize it. But isn't it, it's housed, though, at the Trezor, right? At the, Leeuwarden, is that how you say it? Leeuwarden?
Leeuwarden, yes. Yeah. It's the capital of the province of Friesland.
Yeah.
Yes, and, you would say, like I said, even if it would have been a work of art of the 19th century, it would be so unique in its kind that it would be interesting to study and to make a documentary about or to. But that does in the 60 years that we have had television, it has been not a single time on national television. There has been things about it on local Frisian television, always confirming the idea that it would obviously be forgery or a mystification. And on radio, I think there have been two short interviews only of a few minutes about it. So the first interview we had was actually the first longer talk that was done about it.
It's amazing.
And now it's the first time we will show things on video as well.
Yeah, exactly. I'm running a little bit from one of the documentaries, or actually your video that you did on it, but you had some of the excerpts that has been touched, or the mainstream media, rather, in Holland that have touched on that.
That was not mainstream. That was only local television.
Oh, it was only local. Okay.
In Friesland, so not a national television.
I see. Interesting. So, so before we go into the depths, if you will, of the book, tell us a bit about what you personally find so fascinating with it. Why have you been attracted to it?
Before I found it, I was interested in Nordic Germanic mythology. I want to know what was known about Freya and the other myths of pre-Christian Europe. When I read it for the first time, I had original language with it, and I read it out loud, and it resonated so strongly. I had so many aha moments, things that fell into place, like the original meaning of words or expressions, the things I knew from Greek mythology, also from school. And what I found fascinating is the origin of language, and with that also the origin of consciousness. During my university studies, I learned about consciousness theory, particularly theories from Rupert Sheldrake. That was in the early 90s. So morphic fields, resonance. And I thought that learning about the origin of our language and of our culture, I would understand more of the psychology of our people, of our race. And that's just a very fascinating subject, by understanding that and by understanding more of the long-term history and the cycles in history, I understand more about other parts of history, more recent history, and it's more easy to project into the future as well. So I discovered it in a time that I was spiritual crisis. I had rediscovered, found a whole new image of reality, of the world, and of myself. And there were so many coincidences in discovering this text that it felt like it was something very interesting for me, and that it felt like a calling to work more on it. And the longer I worked on it, the more it became clear to me that that it is authentic. And if that is true, it's obvious that it's a treasure for our culture. And I always say, I stay open to good arguments against the authenticity. It's not like my work, like my world will fall apart if it's in the end turns out to be a forgery after all.
Right.
Then I've got some true heroes, the people who made it, and it's still a great object of research.
Yeah, exactly. And it is because not much is known, and as you said, the few detailed studies that's been done on it does so with a kind of at arm's length, I'd say. They're like, yeah, we don't know about this kind of thing. But fascinating stuff that it contains. And you have, of course, worked on a new translation on the book. You're translating it and republishing the whole thing and stuff like that, breaking it down. And you've been immersed in this material for some time now. And as I said, we've obviously spoken about that previously on the show. But have you learned anything new as you've progressed forward and as you've written or done the translation, perhaps something even about the book's authenticity in itself that has come to light since we last spoke?
Well, first of all, about the translation. There's one English translation that was made in 1876, and it was a translation of the Dutch translation of 1872. And there were already errors in the first translation, and when you translate a text, then also things get lost. So this will be the first English translation straight from the original. And initially, I thought it would be best to make a most literally possible translation. But during the process, I found out that that is not the best thing to do, because many words have gotten a slightly different or a totally different meaning. You already see that in different European languages, where there's words that are exactly the same and the meaning is slightly or very different. So if you translate certain words with the modern cognate that exists, then it can sometimes become become confusing. And I really had to do a lot of word studies to study a word in the context, in the various contexts that it is used, to see what the meaning or the meanings. Many words have various meanings. This translation is really after having studied the whole text and learning to think how these people thought. At least I've tried it to do that as good as possible. And because nowadays it's really easy to look up words in many different languages, even dialects. I've done many, many discoveries of improvements of the existing translations, many little improvements, a few really significant ones. So that is new. And about the authenticity, something very interesting about the paper. From the start, they said this water has water lines. We can show it, perhaps. And therefore, it has to be machine-made 19th century paper. I've pointed out in my video that there's Arab Spanish paper from the 13th, 12th century that has exactly the same water lines. So the conclusion from back then was not valid. And I think 10 years ago, or a bit less, there was a research team who wanted to prove from what year this paper was. And they excluded the possibility that it would be medieval. So it had to be 19th century, and they wanted to see if it was 1830, 1840, 1850. And there was a preliminary report of this research. Was published in a small magazine for people who work in museums. And after that, nothing was heard of this investigation. So the interesting thing about this is, you would say it would be really easy with the modern techniques to establish how old paper is. And if they could indeed prove that this was 19th century paper, they would have published this, and it would be known. But since they have said nothing about it, since it can only mean that they didn't get the results that they wanted. In other words,
so they do studies on it, and then they just kind of keep quiet about it, basically.
Well, they did a few years ago, and then suddenly nothing was heard of it anymore. After they had put quite an effort in this investigation, mm-hmm, with all the modern techniques. So that is something I pointed that out 2 years ago when we talked, and since then nothing has come up either. So that would be a confirmation that the paper will not be 19th century and therefore probably 13th century after all. And if that is the case, then well, the whole manuscript is 13th century.
And also, of course, then we should mention that although it's 13th century, 1200s, that it was written, that is, the idea is that that was a copy, right, due to a flood, I think, that happened at that time. So it was decided to, after time, it just starts falling apart as well. But it had been copied, I guess, in the Linden family, right? It had been written down by many of them in their family. But how long, reasonably, do you think it goes back? When was the potential original written? There is something mentioned about that in the book itself, isn't that right?
Yes. The book starts with two letters, one from 1256. That was someone with the name Uralinda. Who explained that he had to make a new copy because the old copy had become wet and fell apart. Then the second letter is from the year 803. That was someone who just explained his descendants that they had to be very careful with this and not let it fall in the hands of monks, because then they would destroy it, like they tried to destroy everything that that was from their old culture and from their ancestors. So those are the two most recent texts, these two letters. And then it starts with the original texts that were compiled in the 6th century BC, 600 BC. It explains that in that time there were threats from invasions. And they wanted to prevent that the texts that at that time were written on the walls of the burghs, and the burghs were like perhaps later the monasteries or strongholds.
Yeah.
And there were also texts not only on the walls but also written. The documents that were kept there. So in 600 BC, they have collected the various texts that were around in these different burghs. And after that, texts were added by following generations. In particularly the 3rd century BC, 300 BC, many texts were also added. A lot of things happened then. And up until about 50 BC. So the texts are compiled from the 600 BC until 50 BC, but the texts that were initially collected, some of them have much older histories as the topic. So it describes events that were even much older, as old as more than 2000 BC.
Yeah, it's like any, the oldest. Like any of the books written by Tacitus or Jordanus or any of these people, right? It's like, sure, they might have written in the year 300 or whatever, but it tells a story which is much older. That was the initial reasoning for writing them down, because it was, you know, stories and mythologies that were lost. So it's very much the same idea within this book. So it makes it difficult, obviously, to date it exactly in terms of when it was physically written, right? But that doesn't matter to a certain extent. If it's a copy of something very, very old, that becomes highly interesting. So let's talk about the language a bit that it's written in. It seems there seems to be few correlations to the alphabet that was written. Is that correct?
Well, many of the letters look similar to our so-called Roman capitals. Some letters are very different, and these letters are based on the six-spoke wheel.
And I'm showing, by the way, for the radio audience here, I'm showing that that portion of the book that shows the six-spoke wheel with all the different letters and how they were drawn up. That particular image, if we look at that from the book of this little diagram or whatever you want to call it, that's like an instruction, I would assume you could say, of how all the individual letters were created. Is that correct?
Yes. And I think this will have been very helpful to keep the original shape and not allow varieties to come into existence and to lead a whole new life. There's also text in these in the manuscript that describe how this alphabet was compiled and how important it was that that it remained pure. They were obsessed with keeping the culture and the language and the script pure. And there's much talk about other cultures where there's bastardization or younger generations not being able to read the text from their ancestors. So, well, I will make videos about that in the future because it's quite complicated.
Yeah.
To summarize now.
It is, but it's a very interesting idea also that it's based around the wheel, right? That it's like it has dual meanings, obviously, because we know that the veneration of the cyclical was important to these old people, and the word wheel in this old language, you say yule, which is, I believe, related. It's got to be related to the word yule, the celebration, the Christmas times, basically, because it was the completion of a whole circle, a wheel at that time. So there's there's metaphors within this of why they might have used this shape, etc. But it's very interesting that that it's also a sign or a symbol of civilization itself, the wheel, right?
Yes, it's a symbol of time, the wheel of time. And it was also the symbol of the most ancient one, as they called it, what we would call God. They had the concept of the beginning of time, the beginning of everything, the beginning and the Anfang. In German you say Anfang. Anfangen in Dutch. These concepts were sacred in this culture. And the word Yule, it's maybe good to point out that in the Scandinavian languages, Yule also means wheel.
That's right.
Isn't it?
Yep, that's correct. Yeah. Yep.
So in this book, the word for the Yule feast, the Yule tide, and for this wheel, is exactly the same. So it's one concept.
So it makes sense. And that's why also, when I read some of the words, and I can't read it like fully, obviously, but there's some things that stand out to me. Here I see a word, for example, moeder or, stand, I understand stand. There's things like that pop out of me, like, oh, that kind of makes sense. And I'm reminded of, and this, I don't know if this correlation works or if this is a sensible way of describing things, but, in the Gothic language, which wasn't a written language initially, there was a priest that came along and kind of, he invented the language, Gothic script. I mean, it wasn't around before then. To a certain extent, there's some similarities with this also, to be honest. There's a silver Bible. He translated certain passages of the Bible into the Gothic language so that it can be read. He wanted to convert the Goths, basically. But I'm thinking if there's something similar that happened here, that they might have had primarily an oral tradition and all that kind of stuff. Eventually, when languages started popping up, they realized, hey, wait a minute, this is actually a good idea. Let's write it down, right? The other way of preserving it. And so it doesn't mean that it's fake. This is what I'm trying to say, that yes, the alphabet itself might have literally been invented in a very short time, but it was done to be able to tell the story. Is there any likelihood that that's kind of the scenario of what happened here?
In that case, some of the histories would have been made up. Of course, about the oldest texts that are described in here were already 1600 years before these texts were collected. So it's always, you never know what exactly is true of that. it would be very interesting to investigate this. But one interesting thing about these texts is also that I have noticed that there is a variety in style, choice of words, and spelling between the various texts, which would make sense if it is written by different authors in different times or in different places. If what you say, it was at one point written down by one person or one group of persons, then you would expect more to have one particular spelling throughout the whole text.
Right.
Yeah, you understand. The oldest texts have a slightly different style and spelling and choice of words than the newest text of 300 BC, for example.
Interesting. But what I'm saying is that even though it was written by different people, that initial diagram that we show might have been like an instruction, right? Which said, here's how you would, if you continue writing, these are the letters you use and this is how they're constructed. It could be, because at some point we could argue about anything of like, well, when was any language invented, right? I mean, reasonably, sure, it went from pictograms and stuff, but if you go back to Phoenician and stuff like that, which has some correlation, you probably had people at some point that like, probably sat down and like, okay, well, let's try to kind of construct something here that makes sense. And it could be something similar with this. So what I'm saying is people shouldn't, you know, throw this out of the window if it shows that it was someone who, you know, kind of came up with it on the spot, same as a silver Bible. Someone came up with it on the spot because they wanted to take an oral tradition and make it a written tradition. So, but yeah. We don't know. We don't know the story.
Very true, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, we talked about the Yule a little bit. What do we know about the author? Is the author mentioned? Now we're talking about multiple, obviously, but the first one, the original one. Do we know anything about this person who wrote it?
The first one, you mean in the 6th century BC?
Yes.
That was a group of people who were responsible for collecting these various texts from the various burghs. So it says this text was written on the wall in this and this and this burg. These are the laws that were written here. And only in the second half of the book there are reports of individual writers who explicitly say who they are and why they added certain texts, or where they found them, from whom they copied them. So, the first part is a compilation from the existing texts. There is mention of a folk mother Vesta, who would have written down the oldest text, but that must have been around 2000 BC or something, so it's not clear how historical that actually was. But that's the name that was mentioned.
So,
is that what you mean?
Yeah, exactly. And so that's interesting. That's a kind of a compilation, if you will, or that these different, the burghs, which is, of course, where we get the word that's used in both German and Swedish too, like Gothenburg, for example. Connotation, as you say, an enclosure, a specific area, a protected area.
I think in English you also say borough.
Borough, I guess it would be, yeah. Borough, Borg in Swedish.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. But what about the book initially, how it came to light, it was handed over by a gentleman called Cornelis Over de Linden, which is, he was part of de Linden family, right? And they claimed, I guess, some kind of royal kinship, that it had been left in their family for many generations to, you know, he received it from his grandfather, he said, for example. And then, you know, the idea is that it had been passed throughout his family. Is that right?
Yes, the story of how he got it in his possession is quite complicated. That must have been 1848, but it was not explained to him, really, what the text said. His grandfather would have had it, and before that, there's nothing known. it is possible that this family had this manuscript and was able to read, or perhaps they could read everything, the name Uralinda, and perhaps they took the name over the Linden because they had this manuscript. So it's not clear, it's not certain that this family was actually the same family who already had it in the 13th century, of the one who copied it, and before that. But anyway, what is clear from his own witness account is that he got it in the 1840s. He tried to decipher and read it. He didn't manage. He had collected several dictionaries. But because he didn't succeed, he asked for help. Now, there's something very interesting about how he got it and what his own account was, but I will explain that in a video log on my YouTube channel later, because it's so complicated that I have to prepare that, and for this show it would be too detailed. But
yeah, there's many tentacles to this, because you have all the different authors, the proposals of the people that came along at specific times. You know, there's several, like the footage that I have been showing a little bit here in the background, from the local news station that you mentioned. You know, they talk about this one priest, for example, that, you know, he apparently had an agenda to ridicule Christianity, and they say that he just came up with it and stuff like that. But what we can say is it's far too complicated for that, and there's enough tentacles to investigate to that makes it highly interesting, if I put it that way, which mm-hmm. shows that it's something more than they just claim. And even some of the, I think you showed him in the documentary you did a while back, many years ago now, about one who'd won the author's prize, I guess, in Holland at that year. He talked about how if it is a forgery, then or if it's made up, then obviously that author had an immense creativity, which he would have been talented to keep his talents hidden, I think he said, or something mm-hmm. like that. So, you know, it's interesting, many different tentacles. But the new translations that you've done, tell us just a little bit about that, and how long the book is. You know, we know that there's some missing pages and stuff like that, but you're planning on releasing the entire book as is, and also with a translation to that accompanying that. Is that correct?
Yes, what I would like to do is to publish both a copy of the actual document, full document, with a line numbering, then a transliteration, so the original text, but then in normal letters, and then the translation. So these three things, so that the translation is really easy to compare with the original text, and then with the manuscript itself. Yes, I wanted this because I want to do further research on the text, and then I want to have this to refer to. I don't want to be dependent of the existing old translation, because that in many ways is now so much improved, and in other ways also not really easy to compare with the original language. So this should be a source for further scientific research, not only by me, but hopefully by other researchers from different fields of research. Yes, hopefully this will inspire much new research, and also bring many new discoveries to light.
Yeah, exactly, indeed. Tell us a bit about when you plan to release the book, and I know that you've been talking a little bit on and off with Greg Johnson from Countercurrents. He might be interested in publishing, as far as I understand the situation. Are you going to make your own kind of additions to it, or do you want to keep it as kind of as pure as possible? What's your intentions?
Well, I will try to write a good introduction too, from my perspective, and Siobhan will write one, she said, and hopefully if Greg publishes it, he will add something to it as well. I am not a very good writer, I think. So I don't know how much I can add to it. I will try not to write too many footnotes to this edition, because the header often also distracts from the text. This will be a text that will be good for a first, for people who read it for the first time, and
are there things that you could have inserted and injected? I mean, if we just talked about what you maybe would like to do in the future, because the work could certainly be correlated with maybe other texts, like Sivan mentioned, for example, that you know, you could actually go into like the archaeological record. You could actually go into who knows, maybe even genetics or something. But but definitely, you know, the different tribes, the different areas, specific things that's described in the book to kind of prove it outside of the book itself. Would you like to do something like that?
Yes, there's much about race in this book, and that's, we haven't talked about it yet. And that's also, of course, one of the reasons why I thought Greg Johnson and why Countercurrents would be a good publisher, and also explains why it is not much talked, why it is shunned by by mainstream academia.
Yeah, because it talked about a specifically a white culture, and I remember the video that you made on it. In the, I think again that was a local piece. They almost talk about it in a little bit of a down. You know, they put it down like, oh, they talk about this old white advanced civilization that used to be all around in Europe, right?
It is referred to as a racist, this text. There are texts.
It's got to be good, folks. I mean, think about it. Well, it's got to be good. You know, they're putting it down like that. It's got to be something in there, you know.
At least interesting. And that there's a little fragment here from, let me show the, oh yeah, Tacitus. Wrote of the peoples of Germany, this is from a translation, have never contaminated themselves by intermarriage with foreigners, but remain of pure blood, distinct and unlike any other nation. One result of this is that their physical characteristics, insofar as one can generalize about such a large population, are always the same. Fierce-looking blue eyes. Well, you could say, oh, that's a very racist text by Tacitus, but...
Not really. It's just describing the people. They were, I mean, at that time, they were interested in almost the taxonomy of the tribes that they encountered.
It says something about the paranoia that we have in our time to, to discuss things like this.
Yeah. How is that a bad thing, or just like literally pointing out the unique traits of a tribe? I mean, what's there's nothing wrong with that. It's just, that's ridiculous.
Well, it is confirmed in these texts that these people were really obsessed with keeping their blood and their culture pure.
Yeah.
And there's a few explicit mentions about this. Also, sometimes contradicting. There's one maiden or one folk mother, a maiden, I think, who said, well, the other races will exterminate each other, and we will then populate the empty spaces. But another folk mother has a vision that in the end, the three basic races that they saw would cooperate. They would not mix, but they would all contribute their strong sides to the common good, to the whole. The black people would have their strength. The yellow people or the light brown people would have their inventiveness, and the white people their wisdom.
Interesting. So that's
there's
mentioned
a few
examples
there, right? Like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
You asked about topics, fields of research. Personally, I would be really interested in several things, and this will be a life work, so I will never be bored. there is a tradition of Frisian historiography from the 16th and 17th century that also talks about some of the things that are topics of this book. And these texts from the 19th century on have always been labeled as pure fantasy, total nonsense. And not only that, there are very few people in the Netherlands who even know that they exist, of Friso and the origin of the supposed origins of Friesland. And from Friesland, it is good to know for the listeners that what is now the Netherlands or Holland used to be all called Friesland or Frisia.
Yeah.
And that is a known historic fact.
And was it meant free land, right? The people of that are free. Was that a translation?
Well, that's something that in this text becomes clear, that these people were obsessed. Well, obsessed is a strange term. The meaning of the word Freya was free one, as opposed to being slave.
Exactly. Yeah.
They really despised the idea of parasite people who gain excessive wealth and power by exploiting
enslaving others, right?
By forcing other people to work for them or pay excessive taxes.
Yeah.
That's of course that already makes it clear why already in the 19th century, but even still today, the establishment would hesitate to let this become very well known.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a history. Yeah,
because
here.
many people would recognize this as an ancient frustration of having to pay taxes, to feeling like a slave of the government or of the in earlier times of the king, of the prince. Yeah, in the Netherlands, there's also been many centuries of controversy between the people who wanted to have a royal family, the House of Orange, and people who wanted to abolish that, even up until quite recently. So that, and of course the power of the church, which was very strong, and nowadays we have a different sort of church or religion. Most people, or many people, would not recognize as such. But so the Freya or the Freyas, they saw themselves as free, and they saw many other peoples or races as more like slave people or slave owners. And they despised both. That is a topic that returns in many of the texts. And Frisia or Friesland could be derived from that. But the Phrygians from other recorded history are sometimes in the 13th century, I think, already interpreted as Frisians. There is an English the story of England from the 13th century talks about a Frisian or Phrygian who would have written down the story of Troy. I can send you the text later. So Frisians, Phrygians, there's so many links in other old cultures that this is not about the Frisians only. According to these texts, also the Germans, the Germanic tribes would have stemmed from this. Many of these people would have settled along the Scandinavian coast and in what is now the United Kingdom. And very significantly, already in 1500 BC, they would have had colonies in Athens and what is now Greece, the Ionian Islands, the Mediterranean coast. And soon after that, a lot of them migrated to the northwest of India, the Punjab. There's also many geographical names there that can be perfectly explained through this language. Same goes for many Greek names. of places and of people from and of mythological names.
Let's take one example. Sorry to interrupt, mm-hmm. but let's take one example in India or the Punjab, right? The mountain range, the Himalayas or Himalayas, mm-hmm. Which has been broken down as meaning, well, Himmel is the first part of it, which means in German they still say Himmel. We say the same in Swedish, Himmel. Mm-hmm. And then Laya is where something lies, right? So it was such a high mountain, a tall mountain, that it was where the heavens lie, right? So you could actually get to the heavens by, you know, there's stuff like that in the books, which is pretty interesting.
Yes, Laya or Laya, this could either mean lead to the heavens or lie in the heavens,
mm-hmm.
yeah, which would both be plausible. That meaning is suggested in this text, and it doesn't have to be the official real etymology, but that is what people at that time thought, and it would make sense. There are also suggested etymologies that at first sight seem very strange or weird. But it's good to point out that for example, for Dutch people, when they hear Flemish, which is a variety of Dutch, or Afrikaans, the language of the Boers in South Africa, they also often think it's really funny. Yeah, because some words are very different or used differently or they're not used to it. Well, there's etymology of Neptune, yeah, and the well-known sea god, which would be split in Neith and Tunis. And Neith is a very old word. We would say, oh, it means nephew. And I don't know if in Swedish you have a similar word for cousin or for nephew.
Yeah, say the word again.
Nave or nephew?
Nave, yeah. No, actually not. We would say bror, son, brother,
oh, yeah,
son.
Okay.
But maybe there's an older word, but no, not that I can mm-hmm. recall. No, it doesn't ring a bell.
I've made a list once, and there are many different languages that have a variety of this word,
mm-hmm.
and it also sometimes means just kinsmen. So there's Tunisia, and in Tunisia there's many mosaics of Neptune. So it's not that strange that part of this name Neptune was divided into Nep or Nef, and P and F are very closely related, and Tunis. Which is still a name here, Tunis or Tony. Yes, and in Greece, Athens is explained here as coming from At or Ate, which means ally. And it explains that when they created Athens, it was named that because they came there as allies and they were allowed to settle.
Very interesting. So there's many, many tidbits and things in the book, obviously, that they can stand out to people and they can explain things. But let's touch on one aspect, and then we can take a short break and continue with the second part. I want to get into more of some of the other things, exciting passages to you, things that you really kind of like that the book talks about. But tell us why you think people should care about the book. Why is it important in context to, you know, things that are going on today? I mean, do you feel there's a relevance to it? Obviously, it's what Siobhan said earlier. I would agree with that, which is the most fundamental part. It has to do with identity and us losing things today. And I personally feel that the longer back in the record you get, the more exciting it gets for some reason, right? The closer history is, it's still interesting, but it's not as interesting. Way, way, way back that we go, that there's something fascinating with that. There's something just exciting about learning about those things. And this work is exciting for the sense that it gives us maybe not a different, altogether different story, but it tells us of something which we kind of get through other mythological records about this old people that were wide. They had a widespread culture. They gave a lot of technology, knowledge, and things like this to many other tribes that preserved and picked up on these things. But especially if they traveled as far as India and into, you know, Central Asia and stuff like that, that would almost imply a reverse kind of, you know, we hear about the Aryan invasion, for example, of them coming from the Indian continent and going up to Europe and that way. But this almost tells it that it's the other way around, if this is true.
Well, it tells both, because there were settlements in Greece and India, and then in 300 BC, many of them came back. There was a huge remigration and resettlement in Northwest Europe. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. That's fascinating. And that's what I've always thought. I've talked with other guests about that too, that why would they only move one way and that was it? You know, there's no reason for that. They could have moved back. Other things in the environment could happen, such as floods, for example. We know about this particular region in Holland, how flooded it was. If you guys didn't have the banks there, obviously, that water would have poured in. There are stories out of the historical record that, what, between like Denmark and England, there was this old landmass area, which is potentially kind of the root of the civilization in that area. But as things flooded, which the book talks about, they were forced to migrate. They were forced to move, right?
Yes. The initial migration to Greece would have had, according to this text, another background, a conflict. But 300 BC, there would have been a big flood catastrophe all over Europe. And
That's when the Teutons is speculated. The Cimbri and the Teutons, they I think left earlier, but there's a similar thing in the mythological record that there was some kind of environmental, not collapse, but it was something that happened that was bad enough for them to being forced to more down to the southern parts of Europe. But anyway, you were saying?
Mm-hmm. After they had helped Alexander the Great, many of them returned and resettled because there was so much empty space after this big flood. And that is what this text explains, and that those are the most recent parts, and I think also the most, for me personally, most interesting to study and compare with other sources. There are other sources that that talk about this, about the resettlement from India, in what is now the Netherlands and Germany. It would be particularly interesting also to study more of the material from that area, and not only the text about Alexander the Great, perhaps also new archaeology that is discovered, but perhaps also from Sanskrit. One thing to mention is that I don't know much about Sanskrit, but various Sanskritists have pointed out the many similarities with this language in particular and Sanskrit.
Interesting.
Also, the Zoroastrian religion or tradition has many parallels with what is described in this manuscript.
Fascinating. I'm showing the your blog here, your website, while we were talking about this too. Let's direct people there as well, because there will be much more information there for people. You're talking about getting back into video production. When did you did the first one? Back in 2013, the first the video?
I think so, yeah. I made a few in a row, and then my computer crashed, and I became father, and I didn't have the time and the inspiration to make new videos. The new videos that I will make will be more like me talking and pointing out and showing illustrations. Yes, this blog has been a collection of discussions that there have been on a forum initially, and of various things that I found, and I wanted to archive them for myself. Also, many word studies of individual words, the different fragments. So they are meant to for other people who want to study the text as a guide. there is so much information on that blog that even when I browse through it, I get overwhelmed by it. So it could be a good start, but I want to make something. The first priority now is to make this translation ready and available. Then I will work on a new website with a good introductions for people who are new to this,
mm-hmm.
and gradually guide them through getting to know it. And another thing I want to do in the after the book is ready is start a research foundation from where we can, for example, take initiatives to have the paper properly researched and really establish the age of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And to organize specific research questions to analyze it. The whole text is way too much for one study. Every single text could be a topic for a whole PhD. Well, not every single text, but many of them.
Mm-hmm.
And to look at it from a theological perspective, you asked earlier, what's the relevance for our culture or for our race? Well, studying these texts becomes, you get an idea of what was there before Christianity. And it was not just what many people think, the Norse gods, Odin, Freya, Thor. That was one tradition, but there was also a tradition that I sometimes say that the good things about Christianity already existed here before Europe was christened. And they took many things that were already here and implemented them in the new religion. They also added things that are foreign to us. Ever more people step out of Christianity, and especially in the 30s, there was a huge movement that wants to get rid of the more Jewish elements of Christianity and the Old Testament. This can give an indication of what was already there and what fits more to our folk soul or folk consciousness. At least for me, this was a strong, I felt a strong resonance and a feeling of coming home, of becoming more who I really am. Since then, and my life has been much easier and pleasant. So, and I've heard from other people who discovered this text that they had a similar experience. And that is one motivation to go on with this and have people get the inspiration from it that they need to get more strength and to feel more who they are.
Yeah, absolutely. That's super important, specifically in these times with all the attacks that we are under, and they're trying to claim that we don't exist as a group, we don't have a history, and everything we did was stolen, and these kinds of things. As mentioned in the book, shows a depth and a dimension which is not even discussed in the mainstream. They're trying to even destroy the few fragments that we have left of that. So this is, I mean, again, it's not an officially accepted book. There's discussions about it. People should know that. But as we know, not much that is in the mainstream these days is worth recognition anyway. So I wouldn't get hung up on the fact that it's not a text that the authority sees as something, you know, seminal or whatever in our history. I find it really exciting for many other reasons too. And just getting something from the mythological record, which is a little bit deeper. You know, I've always liked these kinds of books and things, finds, if you will, that are a little bit on the periphery, a little bit on the outside. But, guys, you can check out, I'll link to this too, but there's a chapters and chronology post from 21st of December last year, 2017, that Jan did, which gives you a good overview of, you know, the different chapters and topics, I guess, in the book too. I'll link to that because that will give you an overview, and that implies also that there's many many aspects to the book that could be studied. But in the meantime, we'll take a break here now, but let's send people to fruskendis.blogspot.com. I'll link it up.
Skitnis is an old word for history. They still have it in Frisian, so Skitnis, Fryskitnis.
Fryskitnis, yeah. Fryskitnis.
Yeah, I should make up a better word for the new website. It's the history of the Freyas, or free history. So it's a wordplay.
Okay, good. We'll have a link up, guys, in case there's difficulties spelling for us, so you just check our website. But yes, a lot of exciting things coming. You know, new translation, the book, website, and stuff like that. So good stuff. But we'll take just a short break here, guys, and then we'll be back with probably a little bit of a shorter part two for you guys. We just want to discuss some other interesting components of the book. So head on over to redicemembers.com. Jan, Ott, and I will continue there. We'll see you after this short break. All right, everyone. Thank you for watching or for listening to this first part of this interview on a somewhat different topic. You know, we like history. We like suppressed and hidden history, especially. I think it's important that we hear about these other stories that doesn't get too much focus. There are sources that basically are alternatives to the current rewriting of the history books that we're getting today. So if you'd like to check out the second part of this interview, please go to redicemembers.com and get a membership. You get full access to our archives. We have exclusive videos, TV shows, reviews, and of course all or both hours, both parts of the interview shows that we do as well. So make sure that you support independent alternative media. Thank you so much for watching and for listening. More coming, by the way, with Hagen Grell on the situation in Germany. Also make sure that you look out for new and upcoming videos. They are all published on redicemembers.com. But you can also, of course, subscribe to our YouTube channel if you're new. And also check out DTube on the Steemit platform. This is a new competitor to YouTube, if you will. We are just starting to upload some of our material there now, and you can, of course, support our work directly through the Steemit platform by the use of Steem tokens. This is a cryptocurrency. It's a new and kind of interesting alternative to ads. They're trying to find a different way that they can make sure that creators get paid by not having ads and also by not being censored, you know, by YouTube. So definitely check it out, DTube. We have links in the description on our YouTube channel below. We'll have links also on redice.tv shortly with more information about that. So it is an interesting alternative. Definitely check it out, DTube, on the Steemit or through the Steemit platform. All right, we'll be right back. Talk to you on the members' websites. Thanks.